I told the nurse 3 times that something was wrong. I want to say that clearly and at the beginning, because when they tell the version of this story that they prefer, the version where everything was done correctly, where the outcome was unfortunate, but within the range of acceptable outcomes, where the chart reflects appropriate care provided by competent professionals, they will not include the 3 times. They will include a chart note that says patient reported mild discomfort at 14:32. That note has my name on it. That note is not what happened. What happened is that I told her I felt like I was going somewhere, not dying, which is the word people expect, going somewhere, like the room was staying in place, but I was beginning to leave it. I had given birth to my daughter 6 hours earlier. She was healthy and perfect and asleep in the plastic hospital bassinet beside the bed. My husband Darnell was in the chair by the window, on his phone, managing something from work, because I had told him everything was fine. Everything was fine. I told him this because I did not know it wasn't fine yet. I told the nurse I felt like I was going somewhere, and she recorded it as mild discomfort. My name is Simone. I am 31 years old. I am a speech-language pathologist. I have a master's degree and a professional license and a life that I had arranged carefully and with significant intention, including this pregnancy which we had planned and wanted and waited 18 months for after a miscarriage that had nearly undone me in ways I don't have language for yet. The hemorrhage began, according to the records I obtained afterward through 14 months of legal process, at approximately 14:47. In obstetric terms, a postpartum hemorrhage is defined as blood loss exceeding 500 milliliters after vaginal birth. I lost, in the period between 14:47 and the emergency intervention that began at 15:39, more than 2 liters of blood. The 52 minutes between those two timestamps are the 52 minutes I think about when I cannot sleep. I was not unmonitored. There were vital sign checks. But the vital signs, my blood pressure specifically, had been trending in a direction that I was told afterward by the hematologist who reviewed my case should have prompted intervention approximately 40 minutes before it came. The blood pressure readings were documented. They were not apparently read in sequence by anyone who had the authority to escalate. At 15:39, a different nurse, not the one who had recorded mild discomfort, walked into my room to check something routine and found me unresponsive. She called for help immediately. What happened in the following 20 minutes involved medical professionals working with skill and speed that I am genuinely grateful for. I was not grateful in the moment because I was not there in any meaningful sense. I was, as I had told the first nurse, going somewhere. Darnell later told me that he sat in the hallway outside my room for those 20 minutes while it was closed to him, watching the people go in and out, holding his phone in both hands, and that during that time, he felt his whole future become conditional in a way he couldn't describe without crying. He is not a man who cries in public. He cried in the hallway. He called his mother, who called mine, and the two of them sat on opposite ends of a phone connection in Atlanta and did not know what to say. I survived. I want to say that plainly, too, because this story's power does not depend on whether I lived or died, and I sometimes worry that the only version of this story that people find credible is the one that ends in death. I survived with the help of a blood transfusion, surgical intervention, and the skill of 2 physicians who moved quickly when the situation was finally named for what it was. I survived with damage that my body has been recovering from for 2 years, damage that affects my energy, my iron levels, and certain dimensions of my capacity to be present with my daughter in the way I had imagined I would be. My daughter is beautiful. She has Darnell's forehead and my nose, and a quality of alertness that makes people in grocery stores stop and stare. I am her mother. I am terrified of what I almost didn't get to be. I spent 3 months after my discharge trying to understand what had happened to me. Not emotionally, that was happening on its own. in the sessions with my therapist, and in the nights when I woke at 3 a.m. with a clarity that felt like something being returned to me after having been taken. I spent 3 months trying to understand it medically. I read the research on Black maternal mortality in the United States. The statistics are not new. They have been reported on extensively, cited in congressional testimony, published in the journals that the physicians who treated me were trained to read. Black women in the United States die from pregnancy-related complications at 3 to 4 times the rate of white women. This disparity is not explained by income. It is not explained by education. It exists across every socioeconomic bracket, and the research is consistent that it is explained in significant part by the systematic underestimation of Black women's pain reports by medical providers. I told a nurse I felt like I was going somewhere. She recorded mild discomfort. I do not know what was in that nurse's mind. I do not know if she made a conscious decision or if something more structural and more insidious than a conscious decision shaped how she heard what I said. I know that mild discomfort is not what I said. I know that the words going somewhere, as a description of the particular dissociation of acute blood loss, are specific enough that a provider with the right training and the right framework of assessment would have heard something in them worth investigating further. I know that the 52 minutes between the beginning of my hemorrhage and the emergency intervention represent a gap that the hospital has, in its legal response to my complaint, characterized as within the standard of care. Within the standard of care. My attorney, who is extraordinary and who I would not have found without the hospital patient advocate organization that connected us through channels I'm not sure everyone knows about, told me that within the standard of care is the most important phrase in medical malpractice law, and that the standard of care is itself a standard that has been shaped by research and practice patterns that have historically underrepresented the experiences and outcomes of Black patients. The standard, in other words, may itself encode the disparity. We are in pretrial proceedings as of this spring. I have been deposed. The hospital has been deposed. The nurse who recorded mild discomfort has been deposed. I am not able to say more than that about the specifics of the case, per the advice of my attorney. What I can say is that I sat in a conference room last fall for 4 hours answering questions about the most terrifying 52 minutes of my life, and that at the end of it, the attorney for the hospital looked at me across the table with an expression that I read as professional neutrality and that I experienced as something else, and said they would see me at the next scheduled hearing. Darnell has been extraordinary. He took the full 12 weeks of his parental leave. He managed our daughter's feeding schedule and doctor's appointments and the domestic logistics of those early months while I recovered in ways that I could not have managed on my own. And he did all of this while also being afraid in a way that he has slowly, over the course of 2 years, begun to be able to talk about. He was afraid that I had died and he hadn't known yet. He was afraid of the version of the future where he was alone in a hospital hallway with a newborn and a phone in both hands and no one he could reach who would know what to do. He was afraid in the specific way that Black men are afraid for the women they love in medical contexts, which is a fear built not from paranoia, but from the documented weight of the evidence. My daughter is 2 now. She calls me Mama, with a confidence and force that I find completely overwhelming, in the best way. She does not know what happened in the hospital room 6 hours after she was born. She will know one day, in whatever form is right for her age and her understanding. She will know because I believe that understanding the systems that shape our lives is not a burden. It is a form of preparation. It is the difference between being surprised and being ready. I was 31 years old and a licensed speech-language pathologist with a master's degree and a carefully planned pregnancy, and I told a nurse I felt like I was going somewhere, and she wrote down mild discomfort. The system that allowed that to happen is not a coincidence. It is not an isolated error. It is a pattern with a name and a literature and a death rate, and the name of the pattern is not comfort. The name of the pattern is something that the hospital's attorneys are very careful about. Her full story is in the episode. Subscribe, because every story like this deserves to be heard. The thing about the standard of care that I've spent the most time with, the concept, the legal framework, the way it shapes what happened to me and what happens in the room after, is that it asks the wrong question. The standard of care asks, did the provider do what a reasonable provider in similar circumstances would have done? It does not ask, was the outcome right? It does not ask, did the patient receive what she needed? It does not ask whether the provider's assessment of the situation was shaped by factors that the provider may not have been aware of and that the patient had no mechanism to control. I could not change what the nurse heard when I spoke. I could not change the framework through which she processed my words. What I could do, what I did, in the moment was speak clearly and specifically. I told her I felt like I was going somewhere. I did not say fine. I did not minimize. I used the most precise language I had for an experience that didn't have clinical language yet, because I was living it in real time without a framework for what it was. And what I said was recorded as mild discomfort. The research on this is extensive and consistent. Studies published in medical journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA, have documented that Black patients' pain reports are systematically undervalued relative to white patients' reports of the same symptoms, and that this undervaluation affects treatment decisions and outcomes. This is not a fringe argument. It is the documented finding of peer-reviewed research conducted by researchers at major American medical institutions. The physicians who treated me were trained at major American medical institutions. The training that shaped how providers hear patients is developed and transmitted within those same institutions. I have submitted my case to the hospital's patient relations office, the state medical licensing board, and through my attorney, to the civil court system. Of these three channels, the civil process is the one most likely to produce any outcome. The licensing board process has been pending for 18 months. The hospital patient relations process produced a letter of response that I found, when I read it, to be the most exhausting document I have ever encountered. It acknowledged that my experience had been distressing and affirmed the hospital's ongoing commitment to equitable care for all patients. It did not acknowledge what the chart said. It did not acknowledge what I had said. I am tired in a way that I don't think fully resolves. The specific tiredness of having to advocate in retrospect for your own care, having to build a record that justifies what you already know happened to you, is a particular kind of exhaustion that women in these situations describe consistently. You spend the energy of your recovery, not on recovering but on proving. The proof is necessary. The necessity is unjust. My daughter said mama for the first time 4 months after my discharge. I was sitting in the kitchen, my iron levels still low, moving more slowly than I had before the hemorrhage, and she looked at me from her bouncy chair and said mama, with a certainty that I think about whenever I sit across from someone in a deposition room. She was certain I was there. She was right. I am there. I am telling this story because being there is not enough. Not when other women in other hospital rooms on other afternoons will say something precise and honest and have it recorded as something insufficient. Not when the 52 minutes between the pattern and the response will be characterized on their charts as within the standard of care. I am there, and I am still paying attention, and I am not done.